Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Did you ever wonder how dishes like meatloaf and casseroles became part of the American culinary canon? Let's find out today on A Taste of the Past. Period after World War I, America, in all its abundance, went from sending food to war-starved Europe to suddenly no longer being the land of plenty. This period, of course, is known as the Great Depression. And for the first time in American history, the federal government assumed some responsibility for feeding its citizens, at least for a while. And we're going to learn all about that, too, because my guests today, Jane Ziegelman and Andy Coe, have written a new book which explores the social and cultural history, more specifically, the culinary history, of that period. It's called A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. Jane was the director, or still does direct, some culinary programs at the Tenement, right, at the Tenement Museum in New York City. And she's the author of 97 Orchard, an edible history of five immigrant families in one New York tenement. And Andrew Coe, a culinary historian, is author of Chop Suey, a cultural history of Chinese food in the U.S. Both of them have been on my show before, and I welcome them back because it's always a delight to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
We were talking before the show that I have done food shows on Depression-era food, and they tended to end up being kind of dry, like the food. No, kind of, interesting, but not, I don't want to say entertaining, because, it's, you know, but it is indeed not as much from the social and cultural aspect that you two have brought into it. And I'm anxious to let the listeners know, you know, what you've done with this. You really have brought in that personal side of things. And, of course, I have to ask, why? What made you approach this topic?
Well, both of us, as you know, have written books about food history. And around the same time, we were thinking about our next projects. And we'd both... You know, we're very aware of the Great Depression as far in the lives of particularly immigrants, Chinese immigrants in my case, and Jane with Italian, Jewish, Irish, German immigrants on the Lower East Side, like what they had gone through and the foods of poverty which they had been forced to eat during the Great Depression. And we realized that this was a period when Americans really had food front and foremost as like one of the most pressing topics of the day. It's when food was really a part of the national daily conversation everywhere, is from people's tables all the way up to the White House. Mm. And we said this is a great period to talk about. Nobody's really written about this in any kind of comprehensive way. And we made it our next book.
Hmm, interesting. And so often the topic comes up in other shows on ethnic food, international foods that I'll do, about the basis of their cuisine being the cucina povera, or the poor food for when they didn't have anything after the war. And it turned out being very good food that has persisted to today. And didn't quite happen here. Jane, what happened instead?
Unlike places like Italy that has this fantastic tradition of a cuisine based on poverty, rooted in poverty. The United States, because of the abundance of natural resources, never really developed that knack for making something out of nothing. So we were blessed in that one sense, but we were sort of deprived in another, in that we had this great bounty of raw materials, and all we really had to do was sort of present them, and never really learned how to sort of eke out a cuisine of really, really humble materials.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we've all read about, you know, the ration books, and some of our grandmothers still had theirs. And Joanne Hayes wrote a wonderful book, My Grandma's War Kitchen. I mean, there were some recipes on what to do when you didn't have the foods you normally cooked with and substitutions. But you present another side of that, and that substitutions were not for the rationed food so much, but substitutions were bland substitutions, I guess, at best, I can say.
Yes, substitutions is sort of the heart of the Depression diet. The idea of substitutions was actually something that came about at the beginning of the 20th century. It was the brainchild of a nutritionist named W.O. Atwater, Wilbur Atwater, who he was a chemist and one of our first nutritionists. He's sort of the George Washington of American nutrition. And he was particularly interested in the working class diet. His idea was that working class Americans were spending too much money on food, and he wanted to find a cheaper way to give them the nutrients they needed and eliminate unnecessary foods like chicken and meat and eggs and butter and fresh fruit, and thereby free up income that they could use that was going to food and hopefully ease working class discontent. Yeah. So that's the substitution has its roots in that.
Well, when you, a lot of your studies and work in this field seem to focus on the city, on urban areas. Is that true? I mean, what about people in the rural areas on farms? They were still growing their own food.
Yes. Well, they were, if they were able to, lucky enough to hold on to their farms, that there wasn't a mortgage and the bank didn't foreclose on it.
Right.
Yes, they could grow their own food, but they could not successfully sell the food because food prices had dropped. There was incredible deflation during that time. So prices had dropped through the floor and it didn't pay to bring the food to market. So people had to live, you know, go back to the old patterns of subsistence agriculture. And, I mean, to some extent, that was good because if the farm was in a good region, you could really live off the farm. But in other regions, life was very, very difficult for people on farms because a lot of farms, particularly in the South, were part of the cotton monoculture culture, which meant that all they grew was cotton. And, you know, these were generally big plantations owned by, you know, big corporations, you know, in England or someplace else. And they really weren't particularly interested in supporting their sharecroppers and tenant farmers any more than they had to. And for them, life was very, very, very difficult. And a lot of them left the farms and left the black sharecroppers headed north up to Chicago and New York and places like that. While for the poor whites, many of them headed west to the promised land of California, which, of course, didn't turn out to be such an Eden after all.
Right, not a lot of promise.
If you've read The Grapes of Wrath, that's a pretty accurate depiction of what the lives of a lot of them were.
Right, right. And, in fact, it's not unusual to see photographs, old photographs of farmers, farmhands, and so frightfully thin. You could see that they were indeed starving themselves to death. Right. So, okay, how bad were the conditions? What was happening with people's diets?
Well, in our book, I mean, it's interesting you bring up this sort of differences between urban and rural America. We really follow those two tracks, and we see them in some ways two separate culinary cultures, which by the end of the Depression have begun to converge. I can give you the urban side. What you see in cities, first of all, is a lot of malnourished children. Mm. And the way that that was sort of discovered by city officials is through attendance patterns at the local schools. Attendance officers began to see that kids weren't showing up at school. And when they went to the children's homes to investigate where these kids were, these truants were, they found out that the kids were either too weak to go to school or didn't have the shoes and clothing that they needed to leave the house. We find that even among the working-class poor in cities like New York, people who once had a reasonably varied diet, and the working-class poor didn't eat too badly, now were reduced to a very mundane diet that was made up mostly of carbohydrates.
Mm. So enter politics and the bureaucrats, yeah. and for better or for worse, how did they get involved and what happened?
Well, the politicians got involved because local charities, private charities, churches, and other organizations like that discovered very quickly in the Great Depression that they could not handle the incredible need that was out there on the streets. I mean, they were overwhelmed, and they were spending all their money and just emptying their bank accounts in order to feed these people. And it was too much. And the first city that realized that something more had to be done was New York City. First, Mayor Jimmy Walker started a weird but amazing effort, which ended up with the police department distributing boxes of food to the poor. And then Governor Roosevelt, which of course was Governor Franklin Delano Roosevelt before he was president, to form something called TERRA, the Temporary Emergency Relief Administration. And this took over giving food relief to the poor on a statewide basis. And this was had never been seen before in American life. It was a really radical idea that the government, that one of the responsibilities of government was to feed hungry people and to feed unemployed people. Because before people had thought, and, you know, under President Hoover, the official policy had been that this was bad for America. This was bad for the American ethos of individualism and the kind of like pull yourselves up by the bootstraps approach. Right. But when everybody was losing their jobs and unemployment reached 25%, and there was no end in sight, there was no prosperity around the corner, that approach didn't work anymore.
So being on the dole was not looked upon as being a favorable thing. But you also talk about the attitudes and the feelings of those who were you on food stamps, that it was a feeling of shame.
Yeah, it was surrounded by a sense of tremendous humiliation. The idea that if you were a man, you could not provide for your family meant that you were an absolute failure. And it didn't help that the government officials who were in charge of dispensing this food added to the shame, the sense of humiliation experienced by people on the government dole by asking all kinds of invasive questions, by showing up unannounced at people's homes to see if perchance there were a new pair of window curtains or if the housewife were wearing a new dress, which showed that they actually had income that was not going to food and therefore were no longer eligible for home relief. So it was, yes, there was a sense of ingrained shame, and then it was added to by the way in which food was given out.
Mm-hmm. Well, then it took a more positive turn once the Bureau of Home Economics was established.
Yes and no. The Bureau of Home Economics, their role in this whole Depression story, it's very big, but it was more they were more the nutritional directors, giving guidelines to the various government groups, telling people what they should be eating and then how they should be preparing it. In a sense, they were apolitical. They were the scientists. Mm-hmm. And they did not become involved in the sort of moral, ethical questions of food distribution.
Mm. And then along came the need for nutrition. We were talking earlier about educating people about nutrition. This, obviously, if you don't have a lot of food, to eat the right foods
yes.
is very important. What came about with that?
Well, what happened was is that under Tara, under Governor Roosevelt, and then under when Roosevelt became president, that plan was expanded nationally into something called FERA, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration. And so FERA handed out either vouchers where you could go to the grocery store and pick up food, and then also after a few months, they began handing out surplus food. And that could be anything from salt pork to potatoes to beans to canned beef and a whole range of other foods. And these food boxes that they were handing out also came with recipes prepared by the Bureau of Home Economics and nutrition advice. I mean, these were pamphlets, these were sheets, which told people how to prepare these foods in the most economical and nutritious way possible. And at this time, people were desperate for nutrition and information. They were desperate because, you know, they couldn't afford to put, you know, the old, you know, calorie-rich foods on the table, and they were worried about their own health, but they were particularly worried about their children's health.
Hmm.
I mean, it was a real question of whether you had enough money to feed your children and feed them. If you didn't, then could you still feed them on a budget with the right combination of foods so that they would grow up into healthy adults? And people were in dire straits about this. And they looked eagerly to the Bureau of Home Economics for this information.
Just to add to what Andy is saying, in addition to these leaflets and pamphlets that were distributed, the home economics women were pretty media savvy, and they used every form of media available to them, including newspapers. So they started a newspaper column called the Market Basket, in which they would disseminate nutritional information and recipes, but also, and this was maybe sort of their most creative way of disseminating information, they engaged in a radio show called Aunt Sammy's Radio Hour, which actually predates the Great Depression, but during the Great Depression became one of the really important ways to get information into home kitchens.
Interesting. Well, we're going to come back after a short break because there is so much more to talk about, and I can't wait. So stay tuned.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com. She said, oh.
Hi, I'm back, and we're talking with Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Coe about their new book, A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. And we were talking about education means and learning more about food during the Depression era so people could learn how to feed their families and eat healthfully. This was around the same time that vitamins were also discovered and much talked about. So there was a lot of nutrition information to be given at that time. But the a lot of the dishes that these home economists were recommending were not exactly the tastiest.
I would concur with that.
Give us some examples of some of the dishes that they were making.
Well, the idea was, what do you do? How do you feed the family if you don't have a nice piece of roast beef or a pork chop? And then, of course, your side of potatoes and green beans. Well, you find meat substitutes. And women look to foods like beans and nuts and organ meats, so very inexpensive forms of animal protein, and sort of made things out of them. One of the really popular dishes during the Depression were loaf dishes. So you had things like a lima bean loaf or a peanut loaf.
So we're not talking meatloaf
here. A liver loaf, no. We're talking meatless meatloaf.
Right.
And these were foods that were made primarily out of some kind of ground vegetable protein combined with breadcrumbs to help stretch it even further, then bound together with eggs, packed into a loaf pan, baked, and then sliced and served with some kind of sauce or gravy. So the idea was approximating meatloaf. Mm-hmm. It was visually, maybe it resembled meatloaf. But I can tell you, because we have made these loaf dishes in our home, they didn't really taste like meatloafs at all. They were, they don't give you that satisfaction that you get from a piece of animal protein.
All right. And, of course, casseroles, as I mentioned at
yes.
the top of the show.
Right.
Dump whatever you have in there. Well, a good way to use up the leftovers as well. Still
right.
is, and is
and
still employed.
Right. And it's a great way to use, exactly, scraps of things, mm-hmm. odds and ends, and then cover them in some kind of, if you hopefully you have the money for, some kind of milk sauce. So that adds additional nutrients, and it sort of covers up your sins. So whatever you're eating, it may not be food that you exactly want to eat. Well, it's hidden under this great creamy robe of milk sauce.
And actually, you can see some of those dishes still exist today. I mean, you think of the classic green bean casserole
right.
made from canned green beans and cream of mushroom soup, which is a sort of Midwestern classic on the Thanksgiving table and things like that. And that directly comes out of that kind of culinary sensibility.
Yeah. Well, interesting you mentioned canned vegetables and or even then we get into later to frozen vegetables. Mm. Industry came into the picture, and a lot of the foods were in fact processed, were they not?
Yes, that's true. I mean, we Americans had been eating canned food since the time of the Civil War.
Right.
So this wasn't
right.
entirely new technology, but the technology was improved vastly during the 20s. And we talked earlier about these home economists. Well, home economists sort of came in two varieties. One were the scientists and nutritionists and dietitians, and the others were women who allied themselves with the big food manufacturers and were employed by the food manufacturers or by the women's magazines who were also allied with the food manufacturers. And these women made it their mission to kind of sing the praises of these new canned foods and then frozen foods, and to try and convince women that there was no shame in using canned string beans or canned peas or canned food of any kind. You could cook foods and be perfectly proud of them and be a respectable homemaker and still use these convenient processed foods. And of course, you could do so in a fraction of the time. So that this idea of cooking with efficiently was really sort of came of age during the Great Depression.
Hmm. Yeah, there was no slow food movement during that time. It was an anti-slow food movement.
Right. Hey, those of us who grew up in the 50s remember eating a lot of those foods. Those were holdbacks, and they didn't go away for a long time, you know.
So well, they're still
I'm sure
still
people
around.
Still cook
yeah.
that way. Yeah. There is, of course, we can laugh at it now, but it wasn't funny, but the story about Franklin Roosevelt, and of course it was known that he liked to eat, but Eleanor had her austerity plan in mind. And tell us a little bit about that.
well, Eleanor. Eleanor was a great supporter of the home economists. And this also, she had a relationship with the home economics movement that also predates the Depression. She saw in home economics a way to both elevate and liberate women. So it was giving women kind of scientific knowledge about homemaking and particularly of cooking that raised the stature of cooking and made it sort of as honorable and as intellectually rigorous as any typically male profession, as engineering or medicine or law. So she was somebody who believed ideologically in the home economics approach mm-hmm. to food. During the Depression, she saw that women could turn to home economics as a way to save their families and in effect, keep American society strong. So it was an act of patriotism to cook scientifically. And she wanted to turn her family into gastronomic role models and to serve this new scientific cooking to her husband. And there was a famous meal which she served him that was made up of deviled eggs that were covered in tomato sauce with a side of mashed potatoes, and then a dish called prune whip or prune pudding was served for dessert. And it was a publicity meal. Roosevelt was asked to give his response. What did he think of this new cooking? And he said very tersely, "It was good."
Well, I heard that you made your own version of the prune whip, and it wasn't that bad, right?
No, it wasn't. It was a good.
It was edible.
Yeah.
It had pretty good flavor. I mean, it wasn't bad. I mean, it would have been better with whipped cream on top.
Yeah.
But then everything's better with whipped cream
right.
on top.
That's right. Yeah. How can you deny that? Well. When you mentioned earlier, Andy, you said that, you know, food was a topic of conversation, but, you know, it was also fraught with, you know, concern, fear, and, you know, and yet here we are today, you know, food is also the center of a lot of our conversations and how different, you know, we've come from that period of time when people were worried about having enough to put in their mm-hmm. mouths and now deciding, you know, what combinations and what it is we're going to eat. It's very interesting that, you know, the basic needs become foremost in your mind, right?
Yes.
The importance of school lunches. I know that you do treat that topic in your book as well, and this is where eventually, a lot of children were probably getting their main nourishment.
Yeah, for a lot of kids, it was their only meal of the day. And it was also tremendously important to the families who were back at home because it meant that there was a little bit more food for the kids that weren't in school. So school lunch became a very important part of the family diet. Hmm. Not just for the kid, but for those at home as well. Yeah. And one of the saddest details that I came across in the research was kids in their lunchrooms at school trying to figure out ways to take some food back to their parents. And one little boy put some chocolate pudding in his handkerchief, and other little kids scraped the butter off their bread so they could bring it home to their moms. These were the kind of details that really sort of brought out the daily tragedy that was unfolding in across the United States.
Right. I mean, definitely poignant
yeah.
stories
yeah.
that, you know, that illustrate this situation. You mentioned something about the kind of the struggle between local traditions and the culinary science. We talked about that with the home economists. But also this homogenization, if you will, of American cuisine. And the refuting, I guess, of immigrant cuisine.
Yes.
Well, yes. During the Great Depression, we think of it as a kind of a turning point in the way that Americans eat. Before the Great Depression, there was a huge difference between the way people in cities ate and the way people in rural areas ate. And it was kind of the difference between the 19th and the 20th century. In rural areas, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's also partially true that they still ate in the 19th century, while people in the cities ate in the 20th century. You know, they're eating canned food and soda fountain drinks and all kinds of, like, speed was very, very important in how they ate. And during the Great Depression, there was such an upheaval in the country of people being forced out of, you know, wherever they were living and forced to hit the road and move to another place. And at the same time, President Roosevelt's New Deal tried to remake the way America produces, distributes, and consumes food. So it tried to remake farms, so no longer would you have, like, subsistence farms, small farms, or farms the workers were sharecroppers or tenant farmers, but they wanted to build large agribusinesses, where you would have mechanization, factories, and tractors and combines, mm-hmm. and for mechanized to produce a lot more food for a lot less cost. And also, they in rural areas, they paved a lot of roads, so farmers didn't have to just sell their produce in the local town, but they could send it to, like, regional centers or to other states. And so suddenly Americans can get a lot more out-of-season produce because they could get strawberries from Florida and lettuce from California in New York during the wintertime. So this was also a big change. And another big change was rural electrification. The federal government brought power all across the United States, and this meant that people could suddenly have electric pumps for water, so they could get water in their house without having to use their sweat, and also that they could buy refrigerators and in these refrigerators store food and also buy frozen food. Bird's eye frozen dinners were coming in at this time. So all of these things were the sort of basis and the foundation of the modern food system that we live in today. The world of supermarkets, of produce being flown or shipped, you know, not just around the country, but around the world. And, you know, all kinds of exotic foods and different food traditions what we have access to every day. This was being built during the Great Depression.
So there were actually a lot of so much concern being on the food that it's a lot of things we learned and brought with us, lessons that we take away from that experience, which we employ still today. I mean, that's interesting that it was something that people paid attention to and learned from it. What do you feel that we as a society have learned from this era in terms of food?
Well, I would say one of the great takeaways was the school, a national school mm-hmm. lunch program. It started during the Great Depression, and we still have it today. And for many children, it is still a very important source of nutrients, of nourishment. And when done right, it's also a great way to educate children about what we should be eating. This is something that the home economists had envisioned and which is still in place today. So it's both, it serves both a sort of nutritional and educational service.
Hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because so much attention now is played into eating healthfully and, you know, are you getting the right nutrition? So now we've even instituted the breakfast program, that no kid should start school, you know, hungry, and there's a free breakfast for those who need it.
And also the government recommended daily allowances, or whatever they're called right now, for just how many vitamins and minerals and things like that people should have as part of their daily diet. That began during the Great Depression mm-hmm. as well.
Of course, that pyramid, as it used to be, is now ever-changing, and now it's a flat plate or something.
Yes, the plate.
Right. So, but it's interesting because you were talking about how food substitutes, meat substitutes, had to be found, and, you know, for the usual meat and potatoes dinner. And that is because of our abundance today. I mean, having pushing meat to the off to the side of the plate, yeah, rather than being the center of the plate, is a movement again today. You know, so it's, but for totally different reasons.
Yes,
fortunately.
Yes,
yeah,
true.
Yeah. Well, it is. I have to say, there are so many terrific stories in this book, and so many in your, the timeline and the, and the involvement of different groups is just very interesting, and even recipes, which is, I think that is a real first in terms of talking about this era of Depression food. Again, the book is called A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression, and the authors and my guests today are Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Koh. Thank you so much for joining me and sharing all this information.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Linda.
And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.